Howdy Monkeys! Hey, welcome! Guess what? I've got dates for you. That's right, East Coast. I will be penetrating you shortly. Boston, your first, September 6th. It's a Friday. I'll be there from 7 to 9 p.m. podcasting. It's $18 at the Middle East Club. Mark your calendars. A link will be up in a few days. And then D.C., on Sunday, September 22nd, I will be in you, 7:30 to 9:30 at Busboys and Poets at the 5th and K location. I am putting an order in for merchandise as well for Sex Nerd Sandra t-shirts, totes, and stickers because I'm going to put them in inappropriate places, but don't tell the authorities. Philadelphia and New York, I am working on dates for you, but they will definitely be sandwiched between the 6th and the 22nd, so keep a lookout. Judging by regional numbers and past experiences, most likely all these dates, as I announce them, will sell out. So I highly recommend you get them online. You'll be able to get all the links shortly at sexnerdsandra.com. I can't wait to see you there. Be a part of the Sex Nerd Sandra podcast. Yay! Oh my goodness. Good. I can't even handle it. The visuals. This week's episode is strange in that I have a fantastic episode on kink gone wrong with expert and genius Jay Wiseman. However, I went to Comic-Con and I wouldn't be doing us as intelligent, excited about things people if I didn't tell you about my first Comic-Con because some wild things happened. My biggest geek out moment was seeing all of these Supermen, seeing the Christopher Reeves Superman outfits, Evil Superman, the Dean Cain Lois and Clark Superman outfit, like all of the suits. Oh man, it was great. I took pictures. It was kind of the best. So I didn't realize how much I liked Superman until I saw it, and I was like, oh yeah, okay. I'm about to pee my pants. Okay. So, the first 30 minutes is all about Comic-Con and my renewed faith in humanity, and after that we get to the dark side of kink. Okay, friends, enjoy.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome to the Sex Nerd Sandra podcast.
Whoa, what are these kids doing in here? Hey, if you're under 18, go ask your mom. Now that we're alone, let's start the show.
Okay, I just need to jump right in. I can't even... Comic-Con, Jason.
Comic-Con. Coolest thing ever.
Comic-Con's... Okay, I need to get really close to you. Like, this is inappropriately close, okay?
Oh, boy.
Okay. Ooh. I had experiences that I can't even... Comic-Con is my first Comic-Con.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Did you not know that?
I thought that you had been before.
No, it was my first Comic-Con. I was completely overwhelmed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you dived into the deep end of the pool there.
Yeah, so, being me, which means...
As you are.
Which means that I'm more of a fan of people than I am of things.
Okay.
I walked Comic-Con for the first hour or two, just going like, oh, this is neat. Like, I was watching people more than things. Like, oh, and just being like, okay.
And that is a whole subculture. That is a lot of subcultures all colliding that you do not see every day.
No, not at all. And I loved it, too, because I'd heard so much about jokes about, oh, the girls who are paid to be in the hot costumes that aren't really nerds. Like, there's a lot of...
Yeah, there's a lot of issues with that.
And people being like, oh, you'll see a lot of neck beards, and people kind of, you know, a lot of sweaty guys. It just, things that I wanted to see for myself. And I saw families and just totally normal, just people. Some people that seemed a little bit nerdier, but really, people just, there was a lot of freaking love in that room.
Yeah.
And all that love was bumping into me because there were too many people in one place.
Honestly, you know what I compare it to for a certain crowd of people? It's a lot like Burning Man, but with a completely different bent to it. There's a lot of things that are not naked people tripped out on drugs. And just the same, at Comic-Con, there's a lot of people who are not neck beards and Sailor Moon outfits.
People make fun of that, and that seems to be all I would hear.
Right. And that's unfortunate.
Yes. So... I have a renewed faith in humanity from Comic-Con.
That is so refreshing.
I didn't know what would happen, but okay, this it's pretty specific. Now, I called you in a panic.
Yes, you did. It was amazing.
What did I tell? Because I was so exhausted by the time I called you from just all the crazy things going on. What did I say?
You started talking about this party that you'd been to that sounded ludicrously overwhelming. Like, you started listing off a couple of the people that were at this party, and my brain started just going haywire, and I wasn't even there. I was just walking down the street.
Oh, so you're, because you seem like, Sandra, I know you're freaking out, but I got to get back to my girlfriend and stuff. I was like, but I have feelings.
I felt bad. Like, hey, I'm walking with my girlfriend, but there's this other girl that's calling, and I'm just going to stand here and talk to this other girl who's not there.
Good point. Mainly, I was hyperventilating practically.
Yeah.
And so you were excited, too.
I was very excited.
Okay.
Like, can I tell them
yes,
who was there?
Definitely.
Okay. I wanted to let you... Anyways, there was Neil deGrasse motherfucking Tyson. You might have to edit that. Swearing.
Say it. Say it.
Who's motherfucking it? Tyson. There was Bill Nye, the science guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then who is the third one that is escaping?
Game of Thrones.
George R.R. Martin. George motherfucking R.R. Martin. And for longtime listeners of the show, you may recall that the last time I was on this podcast, we nerded out hardcore about the end of season 3 of Game of Thrones, and I made some references to the game to Reigns of Castamere. Like, I like me some Game of Thrones. And Sandra calls me and is like, hey, I just, like, met George R. R. Martin and was hobnobbing with motherfucking Scion of Sagan. Like, ah.
Okay. Okay. Let's get it straight. I was at this party.
Right.
And I realized that I am surrounded by Bill Nye.
The gods George, of nerddom.
Yeah, like all George right? R. R. Martin and... Neil deGrasse Tyson, and I left the party because I couldn't handle it. Like, I was I didn't know. I grew up in L.A.,
mm-hmm.
Jason. I grew up in L.A., and I was around celebrities enough, and from a very young age, it was, do not freak out around celebrities. They're just people. And so a lot of my life is just like, they're just people. I've been around lots of famous people.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people who do remarkable things. They're just people. And a lot of the way I connect with people is no matter what they do is just like, who are you as a person? Hello.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't like to just approach someone because they are a celebrity. That's not my style, to the point where when I'm around people that want to meet them, like, I want to run away. Like, I don't want to be near the celebrity.
Well, it's like a really weird energy. You want to get away from that.
Yeah, that energy, because I've been around it enough, and I don't know how to navigate it.
Mm-hmm.
But Comic-Con was, like, the place for me to learn.
Sink or swim.
Totally. I mean,
you're swimming in that shit.
I mean, I met Nathan Fillion this weekend.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
He's like, a sweetheart, isn't
he's
he?
He's a total sweetheart, but yeah. It's just like... Okay, the thing about that party with the Kings of Nerddom... Is you, I called you because I couldn't handle it. Because it's like, what do? You either go up to them. But I only want to approach someone if I have something to say.
Right.
About them as a person. Not like, I really like you because you did a thing that's not you. But now I like you. Even
right.
I don't know if you're actually cool as a person. So I don't.
Like, I've only ever gone up to one celebrity my entire life and done that. And everybody else, like, I've run into Bill Nye like 4 or 5 times at this point at various events. And I've never actually said one word to him, and I love Bill Nye.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, unless it sort of organically came up, he's just a dude, you know?
But in my head, I'm going like, I should care. I should go up to them. Like, why shouldn't I?
I'm losing my opportunity here.
Like, what do I say? Like, why would I go? Do I have anything to say to them? I don't think I have anything to say to them. Well, but everybody else wants to go up to them. Like, but and it's also one of those parties where you're all friends. Like, it wasn't a fan party. It was like, we're all... equals kind of party.
Right.
So then it's just like, I don't know how to do this. But really, you just fucking chill out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I ran away. I walked the Comic-Con floor, and the minute I entered the floor, even though it had been overwhelming me all weekend, just being in the anonymity of a whole bunch of people who loved things going around the floor, I immediately relaxed. And I was like, okay, All right, the masses, the sweaty masses.
Ah, the sweet smell of nerds. I am home again.
Well, the stupid thing is my brain exploded and I was also really sleep deprived. About half an hour of walking the floor, I realized I did have something to say to Bill Nye, the science guy, and I'd actually been wanting to ask him this question for months.
What did you have to ask?
And I had forgotten because my brain was exploding.
Right.
Well, I went back to the party an hour later.
Was he still there?
I walk in and like I saw some of my friends and some other people. Adam Savage from MythBusters showed up.
He is a sweetheart.
He's awesome.
I will go out on a limb though and say Jamie Hyneman is a total asshole.
Was he another person from MythBusters?
He's the guy with the beret and the mustache.
Oh, he seems like the
He's a douchebag. Yeah. Sorry. I'm going on record as saying that, but I know him from way back before MythBusters.
All right.
He's a special effects guy.
Maybe he's grown as a person?
Maybe. Jamie Hyneman for circa 2002, royal douchebag.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I was, you know, an abrasive tool of circa 2007. A little bit.
I was kind of a jerk around 2002 as well, so maybe that reflects more on me. You are correct. Thank you for straightening me out.
I know, I'm fine. I just have hope, you know?
Yeah, you're an optimist. I get to be the pessimist here.
Oh, it's okay. It's okay. Bring
Anyways.
It on. But,
so you go back to this party.
And I see that Bill Nye is, I'm telling my friend, or my guy. I'll just be honest, like, my guy's there. And I'm like, oh, I realized that I wanted to ask Bill Nye something. It was really important. And I turn around, and Bill Nye is leaving the party with his friend. And my guy just shoves me in his direction. Just pushes me.
I love your fella.
Yeah, he's great. And Bill sees me coming, and he's like, I'm leaving. And I go, I have a really quick question. And I asked him about... Basically, I said I want to do for sexuality what his show did for science.
Hmm.
And I had some pre-production questions for him that would be really helpful for him to answer. And the minute that I talked about sexuality and how his show did something for science, he immediately changed. And he totally geeked out on creating TV for a few minutes.
Awesome.
It was so great. And the fact that I had a real conversation out of something I actually wanted to ask, instead of being like, and freaking out. Mm-hmm. It was dumb. Basically, I learned something about myself. You're looking at me like, what did you learn, Sandra?
I don't want to put words in your mouth.
That there is a certain feeling when you're around someone who has accomplished a lot.
Right.
Where it's, am I good enough or am I worthy of chatting on equal footing with someone?
Oh yeah, no, I got that all the time. There were girls back in the day. I just refused to even approach or ask out because I was so intimidated because they were just a big deal.
Right, and what I'd done for years is be like, oh, they're just a person, but it almost diminished them to a point where I didn't want to talk about to them. But the truth is that if someone is accomplished, they're probably quite wonderful to chat right. with. And so in that moment, it felt really good to connect with someone on a real level of something I really cared about and see that they cared about it too. And actually, I went to Wootstock and I was kind of backstage for Wootstock on Thursday night, which was so awesome.
I don't think I actually know Wootstock.
Wootstock, Will Wheaton and I think Pollen Storm put that together as like just a night. I've heard it described as like internet's vaudeville. Like just everybody performs like Hall & Oates. Garfunkel and Oates was there and they performed the hand job song and the loophole song.
Oh, that's the best.
Oh my God. If you haven't seen the loophole or the hand job song, you have to Google it immediately.
Wootstock, yes.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. A huge at Balboa Theater. Totally fun. It was such a neat thing. So then I went to Nerd. Okay, so I hung out with Thrilling Adventure Hour a bunch this weekend. And in terms of learning and about how wonderful humanity can be, I spent time with the cast of Thrilling Adventure Hour, like Paul F. Tompkins and Mark Evan Jackson and Autumn Reese. And the entire cast was absolutely fantastic and fucking delightful. Like, so delightful.
I get such a good vibe from those folk. They seem like they're always having a lot of fun. Just like genuinely good people.
Yes. Yes. When where talent meets community like that, it's and just the
magic
jokes.
Magic happens.
And the hilarity, yeah, is absolutely magical. So I had a really good time with them and I went to their Comic-Con panel. And Nerd HQ, that's where I met Fillion and Zach Levi.
Oh, yeah.
It was really cool to like see them all like sort of prepare for the panel. Like that was really cool. And Nerd HQ at Petco Park, I'm just like, if you go to Comic-Con and you want more access to your the people you love, try and check out Nerd HQ because it's really cool over there and you don't need a Comic-Con badge for that shit.
Really?
Yeah,
oh, yeah, because it's outside. Yeah.
There's so much where you don't need a badge for.
Yeah.
And I didn't even have a badge for Comic-Con. I just kept borrowing people's badges and going in.
Yeah, I've gone, I think, 2-3 years where I didn't even bother to get a badge and I just hung out outside. Mm-hmm. Last year I had a badge and I used it for maybe an hour.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So?
I just hung around outside and went to all sorts of, you know, Trickster.
No, I don't know Trickster.
Trickster is sort of like a bunch of symposiums that are actually about comics that take place at the same time as Comic-Con across the street and is a lot smaller, more intimate, and you get to actually talk to comic creators, which,
okay,
you know, novel idea.
And then, like, I go – I was at the Thrilling Adventure after, like, Fan Mix and Mingle – and
the
I
after hour
right well after the show on
Thrilling
Friday
Adventure after hour
yeah so. It totally
see
was
what I did there.
I don't know, I like that.
Yeah,
I went into the hotel bar and who's sitting there but Dan Harmon. So it was just like, for me it was meeting all of these humans who create and usually I'm not around creators, and it really gave me a sense, growing up in LA, there was a lot of negativity around the, I think, the cliques of Hollywood and sort of the just the in-groups. And I think the way media and creation has sort of diversified.
Well, it's become this whole institution out here where there's its own language and its own strata of creation. And it's so far divorced from the actual creativity aspect of it. That's what I love about comics, is that it's so much closer. I mean, you get like two people and you are creating a whole thing that can become a franchise or whatever, right? And that's, you're just right there, right up next to the creation of it. Whereas Hollywood, you have, you know, you ever sit through the end of a movie credits, you got hundreds and thousands of people on this thing. And there's so much business and structure built around it. And this meta verse of who's on top and who's not. And,
well, I mean, there's still all of that, but I think I saw that it was more than just that.
Yeah.
So for me, it was actually quite healing as an LA kid to be like, oh,
that's why people like this.
Yeah, I like these people. And also, I'm also a part of it. And so it felt good to be a part of it, you know?
You are among equals.
It was. I felt very healed and stuff, and you know, part of the crew. It was very good, very nice.
Right on.
But also, it was funny because I stopped by because the Thrilling Adventure comic book signing was there, and I was hanging out for a sec before we all headed over to the panel, which was a lot of fun. It was my first Comic-Con panel, so it was cool to see.
Oh yeah.
With this girl staring at me, and of course I've got like Paul F. Tompkins and Ben Acker and Annie Savage, like all these people behind me, and she's just staring at me, and I look around me. You know, it's like that funny movie moment where you look around me like,
are you looking at me?
Looking at
me? Are you looking at me? Are you looking at me?
But instead of being mad, I was more like, there are so many things around me right now that you could be a fan of. And she was adorable. And she's in this pink shirt. And if you're listening, you know who you are. And she's just like, it's you. Like, magical, amazed voice, just like, I can't believe it's you.
I saw the last unicorn. It came to me.
And it was so funny because I was like, look, folks, any naughty monkey who wants to meet me, I'll be here. And I said, like, I'll be at the, because I knew where the Thrilling stuff was. So I knew that if I just said, I will be here, if you want to meet me, that's where I'll be.
And she shows up and she's like, you didn't lie.
But I think it was, in the middle of everyone being fans of things, to experience someone being a fan of me and her like almost shaking with excitement. Like she was like a little like chihuahua. Aww. And like she was shivering. And I was like, and I was excited too. I was like, yay, look at us, yay. And so anyway, it was just this wonderful magical Comic-Con moment. And it was cute because I was like, hug? Because I feel like we're huggers. Like listeners to this podcast, I feel like we're huggers.
I think so.
And so it was cute to just have this. She's like, really? And I'm like, yeah, we're going to hug now. So that was great. And then the last day, Logan and Gary of Cellar Door in San Diego, which is an underground supper club, took my guy and me out to lunch at this little foodie place because they wanted to tell us the story of their love story. Aww. So we got to end off our Comic-Con adventure with a wonderful love story.
You did Comic-Con right. Now, you know this, but the listeners don't. My parents brought me up at sci-fi conventions, like in Kentucky. Like I went to these really small community sort of. I mean, Kentucky does not have a huge nerd population, but so I'd go to these things all the time. I didn't go to Comic-Con until I was like 20 or so, and that was over 10 years ago, and it was much smaller. And I've seen it grow and grow and grow. Even when I first started going, I'm like, this is a grotesque parody of what these things are supposed to be. Because it's like these little community-driven things. And I went as a fan with a bunch of other fans, and we would go and line up at outside Hall H or whatever and just, you know, eat up whatever trailers they were foisting on us that year. And I got so tired of it because I was just going as a consumer. I was just going for the business aspect of it, and that's no good. And it was only when I stopped actually going inside of Comic-Con itself, started hanging out with creators, that I started really enjoying Comic-Con. So you're doing it right off the bat. Aww, good on you.
Thank you. Ooh, that reminds me. One, I can't finish this without saying, I went into the, I would say, like the more creator-focused area of Comic-Con.
Oh, yeah. The Artist Alley.
But then there was sort of a little bit of a naughtier area. Because, of course, it was such a family event that I was looking for anything. And the cartoonist from Playboy magazine that's been doing it for decades and decades, I think his name's Doug, had his own booth.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I recognized the artwork immediately. I was like, oh, my God. You're the guy. And his partner in crime there informed me that Comic-Con has nipple police.
What?
And it's a person with a clipboard who goes around and makes sure that all your artwork's nipples are covered. And so...
First off, how do you get to be that guy? Like, what sort of resume does that guy have? Was he nipple police at other functions? Like, did he get sanctioned by the Pope? Like, like, what if it's like a half nipple? Like, I gotta know these things. I gotta know.
I don't know, but they tell you to strap on some stickers over those nipples. They come back in an hour and they check. So they don't want, which is ridiculous considering the absolute violence in comics.
Oh, ridiculous. Yeah.
You know, so you can show someone being torn to bits, but you can't, like, a nipple is, it's amazing how turned on we can get by a nipple. You know, like, it's a drawn nipple, but the fact that that sensation of being slightly titillated by tits.
Titillated.
Can be that much less encouraged than absolute bloody
welcome to America.
Well, okay, we can say welcome to America, but that's a pretty interesting thing. That's just interesting on the Comic-Con floor. I thought that was interesting. I want to finish off with two things. One, through a very odd series of events which involved me trying to get a badge back to the owner of the badge who was on the Nerdist production staff.
Mm-hmm.
P.S. Seeing Nerdist peeps at play, like partying and just having a good time, the Nerdist family worked so friggin' hard, and they were busting their butts at Comic-Con like to bring amazing nerd content to people. So it was great to see them chill out. But on my way to try and get this badge to one of those folks who were at a party, I went by where Chris Hardwick and Matt and Jonah were recording at the Balboa Theater. And I thought that I'd be able to get backstage to the people that I could give the badge to, but that was not working out. But they just handed me a ticket to go into the actual show. So I was kind of like, what the hell? So I ended up near the front at this packed theater to see, and I had no idea who the guest was. Turned out Matt Smith from Doctor Who.
What?
Yeah. So, like, I'm on this, like, little journey through San Diego trying to get someone a badge, and I end up seeing Matt Smith on stage with Chris Hardwick, which is, like, comical to me, but also, like, this is cool. And then during the Q&A, I saw my very first public proposal. Somebody proposed, like,
To their
girlfriend.
Other? Okay.
They were like, you know, I just have one question. They turned to the audience and said, like, Rebecca or whoever, will you marry me? And she, like, ran down the aisle. It was this whole thing, and Matt Smith got down and hugged them both, and they took a little YouTube video. It was so cute.
Oh, that's adorable. I want to go find that on YouTube right now.
Somewhere, yeah. Definitely. No, so it was wonderful, and then I showed up. Just random parties, lots of free-flowing booths. I had a pretty baller time at Comic-Con, Jason.
It sounds like it. Yeah. Man, I got a party with you next year.
I'm absolutely fortunate to know the people. I know some people. You know, like, that's pretty much it, you know. And I met one of the editors at Wired Magazine, Adam Rogers, who's an absolute delight. And he's writing a book on the science of alcohol that will be out next year. And I just can't wait. He's amazing.
What sort of tests is he running? Does he need additional help?
I have no idea. I just know that I know a great brain when I meet one, and he was great.
So. All right. Well, if he needs a great liver, I got one right here.
Jason, thank you for listening to all of my ridiculous adventures.
I get so excited hearing about your adventures. I want to go on more of them with you.
Well, maybe next year, because you know what they didn't have? They had nothing in the way of love or sex there. And I realize it's more of a family event, but there is no...
You gotta spread the love.
Singles ready to mingle sort of thing there.
I think, I'm guessing there's a strong undercurrent, because every, like, smaller thing that I went to growing up, there was the secret orgy room. There's always the secret orgy room.
Well, no one informed me, even though I tweeted it out, about the secret orgy room, but just where is the space to go, like, I like Star Trek, you like Star Trek, let's talk. Like, where is the space for that? Where you can just go if you want to meet other people and maybe see if there are any sparks.
I don't think there is actually a good sanctioned thing. I mean, a lot of people just, you have a lot of people who are very awkward, hitting on a lot of girls who really don't want the attention or don't know how to handle the attention, or it is a mismatch.
Also, I think that it's way too stereotyped that it's guys trying to fight. I realize that the gender imbalance will probably exist, but there are plenty of women who
want to meet somebody
and to even assume who's attracted to who knows. But, like, I just feel like as a sex nerd, I went down to see what there was to see, and I was hoping for more in the way of that. So who knows? Maybe next year. I care about that.
I am in favor of where this is heading. I'm just putting that out there right now. If I can help make it happen, I'm going to make it happen.
Excellent. Where can folks follow you?
JasonPorath.com. Twitter at JasonPorath, all one word. It's pretty easy.
Yeah, that's pretty easy. Yeah. All right. Well, stay tuned, because next is Jay Wiseman talking about all the kink stuff, including autoerotic asphyxiation. Hey, Naughty Monkeys. I am in a kitchen in the valley talking to the epically legendary Jay Wiseman, author, expert, extraordinaire. I just found out you're also a legal court... Wait, a law... An ex-law professor, and tell me everything. Hi, Jay. How's it? Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. So, what would you like to know?
Because when I first met you a couple years ago, I attended one of your lessons on SM101, and I found out all about that you are asked to come to courts and talk about erotic asphyxiation, and so you just told me that you're, like, you have a specific licensing to be able to do that.
It's not a licensing per se. I do expert witness work. I tell people that I am a BDSM catastrophe reconstruction specialist. Have you ever seen that show on National Geographic, Seconds from Disaster, where they look at, like, you know, why an oil rig collapsed or why a plane went down or something like that? I kind of do that with BDSM scenes that have epically crashed and burned. When it's crashed and burned so badly that it's washed up into the courts, I frequently get called to explain first to the attorneys, and then if the case goes to trial, to explain to the jury what was happening and why.
Okay. So I didn't realize that you're so on the case. Now, I love that. Well, I don't love that people can screw up so hard that it gets to the courts, but I do appreciate that you're available for that sort of thing. And as a spokesperson for BDSM, I mean, that's really important. But I know you primarily as the author of SM 101, which is, to me, a foundational book that everyone should have on their bookshelf if they are in the kink scene. You know, like, it's the book I look into to, like, remember what type of candles to use for temperature play or just specifics on flogger use. And so I'm just excited to get to sit with you and chat for a little bit because you've created several books. What are the other books that you've created? Because to me, I'm like, SM101 is, like, tattooed into my brain.
Well, I've done a total of 13 books.
Holy mother.
Yeah. SM101 is, of course, probably the best well-known. Mm-hmm. By the way, for people on FetLife, it's actually a fetish that you can add to your profile on FetLife. You can find it on mine there. It's sold in the six figures. It's internationally distributed. It's been translated into a few different languages. I did Jay Wiseman's Erotic Bondage Handbook, which is a pretty good beginning to introductory level book on rope bondage. And we did a series of actually six tricks books based on the creative thinking principle of looking at something that's already going pretty well and figuring out how to improve that. Like, I realized some years ago that several of my lovers had come up with some little thing that made our sex life a little easier, a little smoother, a little less awkward. And I had thought of a few things myself. And so we did tricks, more than 125 ways to make good sex better. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was it. I thought I was done. I didn't realize I had created a sort of a sorcerer's apprentice kind of thing. People started sending me tricks in the mail. People started coming up to me and saying, "I've got a trick for you." Ah. The stream of tricks kept coming in. So the next year we did tricks two, another 125 ways to make good sex better. This was followed by sex toy tricks, more than 125 ways to accessorize good sex. It was about how to use items you might find in an erotic boutique other than S&M items. Mm-hmm. And the year following that, we did supermarket tricks, more than 125 ways to improvise good sex.
I love that one. I went on a kink tour of Target once and was just like, what can I use? It was very fun.
Thank you. Thank you. And then at the suggestion of our gay and lesbian bookstore distributor, we took those off the market. We resorted the tricks by gender of receiver. We came up with a few dozen more, and in 2002, we published Tricks to Please a Woman, mm-hmm. and in 2003, we published Tricks to Please a Man. At Greenery Press, we knew better than to publish a book on how to please a man until after we had published a book on how to please a woman.
Okay, so you put those out. Which one is more popular?
I don't know. You'd have to ask my publisher about that. I know in selling the books at my appearances, I always sell more Tricks to Please a Man than Tricks to Please a Woman. I think it's because women are willing to be seen buying a book on Tricks to Please a Man, but men aren't willing to admit they don't already know pretty much everything, and so they don't tend to buy that book. Although I think our sales off of Amazon and other vendors, they pull pretty much the same.
Huh, so when we sat down at this here table, I asked you what you're passionate about right now or what's interesting to you, and you said two really interesting things. One being, with all the marriage equality work going on, the idea of, well, I would say a marriage of more than two people. What would be the terminology you would use to describe that?
I'm not sure. Of course, group marriage comes to mind, but my understanding is that the Netherlands and Brazil have issued marriage certificates for three people. Mm-hmm. So.
Ooh, I can hear the lawnmower outside. It's really, this is ambient. This is really giving you a sense of atmosphere, guys. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that this is something that's important for the United States to embrace soon? Because it's definitely, I mean, you'd said before we started, like, laws?
Laws reflect social values, and social values change mm-hmm. over time. I mean, it wasn't until 1967, in the rather ironically named case of Loving versus Virginia, that interracial marriage was still outlawed in several states. Mm-hmm. And given that every year more and more people choose to live in extended families, I predict it's merely a matter of time until they seek some sort of legally recognized standing for those relationships.
Has there been any backlash that you know of in the Netherlands and Brazil?
Not that I've heard of, but they have, my understanding is they haven't granted that many licenses yet. So we will see. But backlash notwithstanding, I believe it's legally and socially inevitable that these things will happen.
It is a valid way of having relationships, but it's such an unfamiliar thing, I think, to most people, the idea of that being a feasible life together. Have you seen it work well?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. If you've heard of the book, The Ethical Slut, I was the primary partner of one of the co-authors of that book when the first edition was being written. That aging hippie running around in the first edition is me. And I think it's going to happen. There's property issues, there's child rearing issues, and so forth. Actually, in a book that I'm very excited about, the book Sex at Dawn, probably the best book out there in terms of, well, how did we come up with monogamy in the first place? I talked about agriculture and as the emerging concept of real estate or real property emerged, parental certainty became more important. The thing I see on the horizon, and I doubt this aging hippie is going to, in fact, I'm certain this aging hippie will not live to see it, but someone your age just might. Given that, again, every year tens of thousands of people, in this case, choose to live in hierarchical, intimate personal relationships, I will predict that there's going to come a day when those people will also seek legal standing for those relationships. We won't be able to call it slavery. That term just has too much baggage.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, there's the Masters and Slaves Together organization, MAST. I've been a speaker at the National Master Slave Conference in Washington, D.C. Many, many people have relationships where they look at a certain, say, okay, that's not my girlfriend, that's not my wife, that's my mistress, mm-hmm. or, you know, that's not my boyfriend, that's not my husband, that's my slave. Or that is the fundamental premise, a power dynamic, a hierarchy of power is the fundamental premise upon which the entire relationship is based. And it's interesting to contemplate what might actually be socially acceptable.
What is the conversation that you've seen around what that would look like? Or are people just sort of like, what could it be? Like, are we just in the brainstorming phase? Or are some people laying out like, no, specifically, this is why it needs to be legally recognized?
I think people have been living in owner-slave relationships for quite some time. I mean, I came into the scene in 1975, and certainly there were many people living in those relationships when I came in. And, of course, the two major changes to the BDSM scene since I came in is, item one, it's a lot less taboo than it used to be, and item two, it's way, way bigger. I mean, FetLife has over 2.5 million accounts mm-hmm. at this point. I've presented in 78 cities in the United States and Canada. I think some people are starting to actually think about, if we were to give recognized legal standing mm-hmm. to these hierarchical, these explicitly hierarchical intimate personal relationships, what would be the rights and duties that came along with that that would be recognized as a matter of law?
That is really interesting. I haven't even thought about that. New ideas, Jay. New ideas.
Well, 30 years ago, the idea of gay marriage was a joke. And today, legally, for all practical purposes, gay marriage is a done deal. I mean, there have been legal scholars on CNN that have pointed out that the path of legal recognition of gay marriage is pretty much exactly repeating the path of legal recognition of interracial marriage.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's completely untenable to have marriages that are recognized in one state and not in another state. And inevitably, this is going to wash up in front of the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will make one rule for the entire country. And the direction in which the social values are going is unmistakable.
So you entered the scene in 1975, you said, right?
That's correct.
So doing some math, that's 38 years ago.
38 years ago this month, as a matter of fact.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Have you seen, I mean, in terms of the kink scene, even in the last 5 years of me being in it, I've noticed a big change. I mean, can you speak on just like what the changes you've seen in the last almost 40 years?
Well, there was a watershed moment probably somewhere around 1994 when a computer manufacturer started routinely including modems in computer. And at this point, our history can be quite meaningfully divided into the pre-cyber era and the cyber era.
Ah.
Back in the glory days of DOS and AOL, charging by the hour and so forth. two things that the internet has done, I think, are pretty unmistakable. Item one, it has brought relatively heterosexual women into the community in very large numbers. And in the pre-cyber era, to find out about an organization such as Threshold in Los Angeles or Janus in San Francisco or Tess in New York City, you would have to go into an adult bookstore and buy an adult magazine and look at the little ads in the back. And an awful lot of relatively conventional women, they're just simply never going to do that. It's not going to happen. The gender imbalance problem among the relatively het portion of the community is much less severe than it was. And the other major change is, there's three changes, actually. The internet brought women into the community in significant numbers, relatively heterosexual women into the community. And the communication of information was really revolutionized. Now you've got tens of thousands of kinksters who've done tens of thousands of hours of clock hours of BDSM play with reasonable success, and they're making hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of posts about what tends to work, what tends to not work. So there's very, very good sharing of information. Like that horrific Shibari double neck suspension fatality that happened in Rome, I think about 2 years ago at this point.
I don't know about this. You're making a face because it sounds terrible.
Yes, well, I'm not highly familiar with the facts of the case myself, but I'm pretty sure I'm on pretty solid ground. As following, there was a Shibari guy in Rome, Italy, who decided to do a suspension bondage scene with his partner and another woman, and basically tied their hands behind their back and took one end of a rope, made a noose out of it, put it around one woman's neck, ran it over a couple of beams, put it down, and tied a noose around the other woman's neck. As I understand it, the basic idea was that they would have to take turns standing on tiptoes so that only one of them could breathe at a time.
Oh my God.
And apparently the woman who was not his partner passed out. And reportedly, he didn't have a knife or any other emergency cutting device handy very quickly. And by the time they got it sorted out, the other woman was dead. And I think his partner spent quite some time in the hospital before eventually regaining consciousness.
Holy, okay. That's a lot to handle. That is a lot to handle. At the same time, I think important to hear, because some people are kind of like, oh, yeah, whatever, safe, sane, consensual, shut up, just do it. But, like, really, it's important.
Well, the case, horrific and tragic as it was, I believe he ended up spending some time in an Italian prison behind that. And, in fact, he may be in prison as I speak these words. As I said, I haven't followed the specific facts of the case very carefully. But in the pre-cyber era, a few people in the Rome community would have heard about it, and that would have been about it. And now the case reports and the follow-up news reports are widely shared on the internet, and that case scenario has been analyzed by various bondage practitioners about, okay, let's study this crash and burn and see what lessons we can learn from it. So horrific as it is, it does have that silver lining that when something really bad happens, the lessons learned from that can be far more widely disseminated than they previously were.
Definitely. And that's an amazing segue to get into the fact that you have been the forensic. You seem to be the CIS of BDSM. There's a lot of acronyms. What are there common mistakes that people make again and again that you see? Or is it pretty specific? Like, is it a communication thing? Is it not having scissors around? Like, what are the things that you just every person who wants to experiment in kink and BDSM needs to know so that they don't make the same mistakes that so many have before?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a student of outcomes.
Okay.
That what we want from our play is a good outcome. And so I've been studying what goes into creating a good outcome, what goes into creating a bad outcome.
When I edit, just FYI. So.
And I came up with the concept I call the minimally acceptable outcome, or the MAO. Mm-hmm. And I decided the acceptable outcome was that 3 days after the scene is over, everybody with what the legal types call an interest in the scene feels basically okay about it. The participants feel basically okay about it. Their partners, if they weren't part of the scene themselves, they feel basically okay about it. If it happened in a play space, the management of the play space feels basically okay about it. It's all good. And in studying large numbers of good outcomes and large numbers of bad outcomes, it's become quite clear to me that by far, the single most common cause of at least one person being really unhappy with the scene 3 days after it's over is rushed or otherwise inadequate pre-play negotiations, particularly with a new partner.
And I would assume that would mean that somebody's boundaries were crossed or boundaries they didn't know they had were crossed. Is that what usually that means?
It certainly can. I mean, there was an injury or somebody felt a limit got violated or something like that. And I picked the 3 day mark because I think a lot of experienced BDSMers have done scenes where maybe the day after they were kind of shaken up, or maybe even like 2 days after they're still kind of processing what's going on. But by about the third day out, they've kind of leveled out. And so who's still upset about the scene 72 hours after it's over and why? And I figured out that pretty much everything that happens in a scene falls into one of 16 identifiable categories. And I created a list of those categories and I put it in SM101.
Yeah. I'm like, I know that sounds familiar. Okay.
And I actually created a mnemonic to help me remember that list. And I've been using that checklist since the late 80s, and I've never had a bad outcome when I've gotten clear agreement on all 16 points prior to playing. I have a success rate, I can say, of 100% on that.
Can we know the mnemonic? Are you going to share it? Are you going to keep it for yourself? Are you going to buy the book, buy SM101 at jweisman.com, right?
My book can be bought in a wide number of places. I will say that if you go to the Greenery Press website, you can find the negotiation chapter, including both the short form and the long form checklist and the mnemonic in a copy and pasteable format. We put that one out there to make it widely available. But yeah, with a new partner, negotiation really is key. It mm-hmm. works a lot better than plunging in blindly.
Do your front end work, and the rest of it kind of, you set yourself up to win mm-hmm. and to live. Set yourself up to live and win. Yeah.
Funny you should say set yourself up to live, because based on the data that I've been able to gather, by far the single most common cause of a BDSM scene having a fatal outcome is a bottom left in highly restrictive bondage and completely alone. I've actually got 3 case reports in my FetLife group of scenes with a fatal ending, and all 3 of them had that in common. Now, highly restrictive bondage, I define as bondage that's so extensive or so intensive that in the event of a fire or similar emergency, the bottom cannot be outside unassisted in 1 minute or less. So they're hogtied or they're tied to a fixed object like a bed or a cross or a chair. But that's not enough. People do highly restrictive bondage scenes all over the planet every day with very, very good outcomes. It's when the second variable overlaps with the first, which is nobody can hear them if they yell for help.
Yeah. That's a bad Venn diagram. I love Venn diagrams, but in this case, don't overlap those two.
Yes. Yes. I talk about, in my bondage classes, I talk about 3 levels of monitoring. There's close monitoring, where you're right there in the room with them. There's loose monitoring, the way a parent might monitor a sleeping child. Maybe you don't have them in your sight, but you can hear them if they yell for help. And as I teach in my bondage classes, restrained patients in medical institutions are assessed by the staff every 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. So about every 15 minutes, you do a check-in. And then there's completely unmonitored bondage. Actually, the worst BDSM disaster I know of, and this was actually...
I'm totally cringing right now. You're like, you're wind up to tell me this next thing. I'm just like, oh, dear. Okay, tell me. Okay.
Okay. Well, again, you talked about Venn diagrams and principles and so forth. The worst BDSM I've ever heard of, worst BDSM disaster I've ever heard of was a self-bondage double fatality. This actually took place up in Canada. There's an old whorehouse trick where a guy and a girl go in a room together and a second girl comes in, and while the first two still have their clothes on, she ties them up and leaves. And the sex game is they start being tied up with their clothes on, and then they try and squirm and wiggle and adjust things around until they can have some type of sex.
Okay.
Well, this couple decides to reenact that scenario without benefit of third person, and while they are both in highly restrictive bondage, their house caught fire.
No!
Yes, and they were both lost.
Ah. Oh. Ah. Oh. I mean... The curious part of me wants to ask about, I don't know anything about old whorehouse tricks. Like, that seems like a fascinating category of activity that I just really want to know more about. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of me is like, totally, that's tragic. That's really difficult to hear.
Mm-hmm. And it is. It is horribly tragic. The lesson that can be learned from this is we see the validation of the risk of being in highly restrictive bondage and completely alone. You know, now there's a refinement on that. I've got a case report in my FetLife group out of Australia of a woman who bound and tightly gagged her ex-husband and went to take a shower. And when she next checked on him, he was dead. The gag had shifted in his mouth and he had asphyxiated on the gag.
Uh-huh.
While she was out of the room to that. And so my teaching point on that is I've talked about close monitoring, loose monitoring, and unmonitoring, that gags are for close monitoring situations only. My basic teaching point on that is never let a gagged bottom out of your sight for longer than it takes you to pee.
Okay. And I think I want to just reiterate, because you kind of touched on it a little bit, but that the phrase highly restrictive bondage to me sounds very advanced, but the reality is beginners will start out with highly restrictive bondage of being tied to a bed, all 4 limbs, etc. So it's not something, I mean, anybody can, in a flash, suddenly be doing that. And you see it on time, all the time, on in movies and whatnot. So I just wanted to double just so people know.
My definition of highly restrictive bondage is pretty easy to figure out. If there was a fire or an earthquake or something like that, could this person, without assistance, get themselves outside in 60 seconds or less? It's a pretty simple test. And you're right. It doesn't necessarily mean tying someone spread-eagled to a bed or hog-tying them. Could easily put them in a position where they couldn't be outside in 1 minute or less.
Yeah, definitely. What now, of course, ideally, everyone would have somebody to watch them, but I know that autoerotic asphyxiation, somebody by themselves wanting to play with breath play, that is something that some people experiment with. The fatality rate is, I mean, you always hear about people and being found dead later on. Is there anything that you wish people knew so that if, I mean, number one, I want to say don't do it. Just don't do it. But of course, just to tell people not to experiment with something is, you know, this is not really the smartest thing. So I'd rather people be empowered with the right knowledge around that. You have any thoughts?
Well, there are certain practices that some people would consider edge play. I think autoerotic asphyxiation would certainly fall under that. I've come to think of that kind of stuff as working without a net, mm-hmm. in that it can go really wrong, really fast, really unpredictably. And once it starts to go wrong, you might not be able to interrupt the chain of events before it reaches its fatal conclusion. Now, like, we don't know how many people engage in autoerotic asphyxiation in the United States every year. The American Psychiatric Association estimates that there's one death per million people per year. So if there's what, like, how many people live in the Los Angeles area at this point?
I know. I'm not sure.
Let's say 8
million.
Let's say 8 million. So we would expect about 8 deaths per year, mm-hmm. just in the Los Angeles area. So now, on the other hand, law enforcement estimates go as much as 4 times higher. So, in fact, I've seen studies that assert that, like, about one hanging death in 3 may, in fact, be an autoerotic asphyxiation mishap. So somewhere between 8 and 32 people are going to die in the Los Angeles area of autoerotic asphyxiation this year. Mostly, but not entirely, boys in their early to mid-teens.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that was the demographic that often shows up.
That's most of them, but young women are making their presence felt. And
oh, yay.
Women's equality and all that good stuff. But we don't actually know how many people. I mean, clearly not everybody in Los Angeles is doing autoerotic asphyxiation twice a week or right. something like that. So we don't know what the risk factor is. Actually, on my website, on jwiseman.com, under my breath play essays, I have a very long essay called Jay Wiseman's Closing Argument on Breath Play, which is a pretty definitive treatment of the medical and legal aspects of various aspects of erotic asphyxiation. And I actually made the suggestion under medical aspects that a person, if they're like dangling from a noose or something, you only need about 10 pounds of pressure or so to close off the arteries in someone's neck. Mm-hmm. And if you figure the average person weighs at least 100 pounds, mm-hmm. I proposed inserting a link made of masking tape into the rope so that if the person passed out and this link is set to break at about 20 to 30 pounds. As they pass out, they'll fall to the floor, and hopefully they'll start breathing again. But it's there's just no question that doing autoerotic asphyxiation is terribly risky.
Yeah. No, it's scary. It's scary, but I just want people to have the right tools. And you had mentioned before we started that you have tons of resources on your website, jwiseman.com, around breath play. So that's great. Mm-hmm. The one that I had heard a long time ago is twisting a towel around your neck. with no knot, but you know how you can twist it up and twist up, like when you put your hair up in a to dry, and then so if you pass out, it just unwinds. Is that still something that would be on the list of possible better if you choose to do that sort of thing? Oh, you're making a face. You're making the I'm not sure face.
Well, as a matter of law, I mean, I even say in my website about my breaking link, I said, I'm not asserting that this converts the activity from an unacceptably safe activity to an acceptably safe activity. I'm not asserting that it makes the practice materially safer. It's something that can be done. And I will tell you, in reading case reports, the phrase failed self-rescue mechanism mm-hmm. tends to show up quite a bit.
Okay. What about having a buddy? Mm-hmm. Are there, in terms of erotic asphyxiation when a second person is present, are most of them autoerotic in nature? But of course, if a person freaks out, they can always leave. But in terms of having a buddy to be present so that if you pass out, you have someone monitoring you, does that help?
Well, it probably helps a little. But again, passing out is a symptom, not a condition. There's dozens of different reasons that someone could pass out. And we know that in some cases, only a few seconds of strangulation or suffocation can cause a cardiac arrest.
Oh. I don't know the ins and outs of what kills a person. You know, mm-hmm. I focus on pleasure, not so much the death part.
Mm-hmm. If you've ever heard of somebody who died from being frightened to death, mm-hmm. it's a similar kind. It's basically the same kind of mechanism. And of course, they've redone the laws in California and many other states. The people who study domestic violence have figured out that a domestic violence incident that involves choking or suffocation is a significant landmark down the road for a homicide.
Oh, my God.
So at this point, 30 states, including California, and I think it's only a matter of time until all 50 states, have passed laws that make choking or suffocating someone you're dating or living with or used to date a felony per se.
Oh, well, that's good to hear, considering all the brushing under the rug of domestic violence. It's nice to hear, you know. The laws are taken into account. So, I want to talk about this really awesome piece of paper you handed me right before you started recording. But first, just so we can arm people with the utmost in Jay Wiseman wisdom around this, I don't want any of the naughty monkeys to fall prey to stupid mistakes that ends up hurting someone. So what are some other common missteps that can get people in the wrong situation when it comes to BDSM? Go!
Well, one scenario that's emerging as distinctly problematic is what happened, is substantial injury being inflicted when a top or dungeon monitor tries to use a knife to cut a bottom free under the stress and turbulence of an actual emergency.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I've got one case report of a superficial injury being inflicted when somebody used a pair of EMT scissors to try and mm-hmm. cut somebody loose. I've got one case report of a superficial injury when somebody used like a rescue hook or a seatbelt cutter, and mm-hmm. dozens of case reports and climbing of fairly serious injuries being inflicted when somebody tried to use a knife. Okay. So, I mean, I teach several dozen bondage classes a year all over the country. And I ask in pretty much every class, how many of you have heard of somebody being badly injured when somebody tried to use a knife in an emergency rescue? And it's pretty much inevitable that two or three hands go up. Mm-hmm. So it's a known scenario.
Whenever I teach a Kink 101 or a BDSM 101 type class, and I bust out the bondage tape or some simple bondage, and then I realize after, when it's time to unwrap them, that I haven't put out my scissors, it's always this like, oh, bad kinky girl, you know, but it's so important because when you're trying to get someone quick out of it, whether it be for a class or an earthquake or a fire, it's you realize how vulnerable you are to a big problem when you have no way of getting them out fast. It's just, it's kind of scary almost to have that happen.
Oh, absolutely. And a refinement on that teaching that I've started adding to my classes is what I call the 5-second access rule. The idea is that you should be able to have your emergency cutting device in your hand in no more than 5 seconds. We've had too many case reports at play parties of a person's out on the floor and they develop an emergency and they need to cut their partner free and they've got the scissors, but the scissors are in their toy bag and their toy bag is leaning up against the side of the room or something like that. Also, obviously, you know, any dungeon monitor who doesn't have a pair of EMT scissors on them is out of uniform. Right. But the 5-second access rule is a real thing. Like in my apartment in San Francisco, I have mine hanging on a push pin by my bed, where I can reach them, but the bottom can't.
Ha 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 ha! Oh, he's the most devious smile right now. any other items of note around common mistakes that come up again and again in the data that you come across?
Well, those are the two big ones. Those are the two big ones. There's other things, but I don't want to get to do too many items in this. They're spelled out in detail in my books, so I'll refer the reader there.
Dungeon Emergencies, the little toy book. The toy bag guide. Mm-hmm. It's like a little green book. And now at first I didn't remember. Now I'm remembering the Jay Wiseman bondage book, and the amount of books that you've written is like ridiculous. Because I have been around. Because I have a huge bookcase full of sex. Sex resources, and I'm just like, you're all up on my bookcase, Jay.
I help out where I can.
I appreciate it. So I asked you, are you working on any books currently? And turns out you help lawyer kids study for the bar exam, which is remarkable. And like, how smart are you? So smart. But I'm blown away that you do that and you create crosswords for law students in preparation for the bar exam.
Yeah, after I got out of law school and passed the bar myself, I taught what is basically, for all practical purposes, my law school's in-house bar review class for 2 years. And then my school merged with another school, and they were happy to take our students and their money, but they didn't need as many professors. Mm-hmm. But people who knew I taught that started seeking me out. And so I'm sort of unintentionally growing a small business tutoring people for the bar exam, and particularly kinky and poly people, you know, helped.
Are there a lot of kinky people going into the law business?
Oh, there's kinky people everywhere. But I will say, when I was a law student, I had an interesting moment. At one point, one of my professors looked at me, did a double take, and said, "Oh my God, you're that Jay Wiseman."
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, it turned out the professor was a deeply closeted lifestyle submissive.
Oh, nice. Oh, that's a wonderful moment. I mean, does it delight you to a certain extent being recognized outside of the kink scene?
A little bit, and actually something I would mention as they're telling you know, gay youths now, it gets better. Well, I was in Arizona doing expert witness work on a fatal fisting case not quite 2 years ago, and because it happened on Indian land, it was a federal case, and I was actually retained by the prosecution in that case. And at one point,
does that mean that you were held captive by them? Like, what does that mean? Retained.
Oh, no, that just means that they consulted me.
Okay.
You know, that was just the side I was on. I'm usually on the defense side, but I have been on the plaintiff or prosecutor's side a couple of times. But at one point, I asked the two federal prosecutors if they knew what a safe word was, and they said, oh, yeah. So they were quite acceptably clear on the distinction between domestic violence and consensual BDSM. And I think if something were to wash up onto their desk, there's no question in my mind that they'd appreciate the difference between the two and would make the prosecutor don't prosecute decision accordingly.
That's heartening. Okay, now I have to ask, fatal fisting case, vaginal or anal? And what was it... just internal damage going on,
or like what, because I haven't heard of any fatal fistings myself. So I'm just curious now, because if you do it gently, everything should be okay. You know, communication, all that. Or are you like, dude, do we have to keep talking about the dark stuff?
Well, fisting fatalities happen more often than you might think. Most of them happen when there's a... Most of them involve anal fisting, where there's a small tear is created in the colon wall and fecal matter leaks into the peritoneal cavity and an infection sets in. And, you know, if that infection gets out of control, it can kill the person. In this particular case, it was a woman and she bled to death. There was fairly massive vaginal and rectal trauma.
Holy moly.
Yeah. Among many other aspects of the case, turns out that drinking large amounts of alcohol is a suboptimal substitute for using large amounts of lube.
I don't even... It just sounds. Are you telling me... No, okay. I'm glad that you touched on the whole alcohol and drugs thing, because truly it's important to stay sober or really close to sober when you're playing that hardcore. But they didn't use lube?
Well, I don't want to get too much into the facts of the case.
Oh, okay. All right.
It turns out it may have been sort of an I'll show her kind of situation. Okay. So the fundamental consensuality of it to begin with is in question.
Okay. Well, that answers a lot right there. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it. Because, you know, it's all about balance of knowledge and knowing, you know, all the human possibilities out there. So I mentioned the crosswords that you had created for people studying for the bar exam, because you're also creating crosswords for educating BDSMers. I'm looking at a crossword titled Anatomy and Physiology for BDSMers. Copyright 2013, Jay Wiseman. And like, okay, 12 across. Fainting is much more worrisome in a person over the age of blank. I have no idea. I haven't the slightest idea. I could just say 60. I could just guess 60. Oh, he looks very smug. Look at you.
Well, one of the things that I've done is I've included a word bank at the bottom of the puzzle. So if you can solve even one of those, then you can probably just by logical deduction. Like if you figure out that you need a seven-letter word in a given space and the fifth letter needs to be E and there's only one word in the word bank that meets that criteria, it's pretty easy to solve. But what I notice is there's certain principles I teach in every bondage class, no matter what the techniques. Like, you know, don't tie them up and leave them alone. I teach that in every class. To me, it's that important.
Now I want to look at the word bank and see if I can figure out what age. 40?
Yes.
Okay. Fainting is much more worrisome in a person over the age of 40. 21 across. A bottom who is blindfolded is at increased risk for... I don't even want to look at the word bank. Increased risk for fun. Increased risk for fear. Maybe like being scared. I don't want to look at the word bank. What do you think, guys at home? Naughty monkeys. If you're blindfolded, you might be at risk of, I don't know, hints?
Well, it starts with an F.
F. Fun. Fear. Fraudage. fine. I'll look at the word bank. Falling? Oh, see, I am... Okay, see, I was imagining that if you're blindfolded, you're just lying there. I didn't even think about play when you're blindfolded and having to do things.
Yeah, you know, people, they do that, though. They'll blindfold a bottom, maybe tie their hands behind their back, and then move them from one place to another.
Touché. You got me. I have a question that's a little bit more bigger picture, because I'm noticing like one of these on here is about the 5-second rule that you had mentioned earlier, Oh, in the event of a bondage emergency, the top should be able to have their emergency cutting tool in their blank in no more than 5 seconds. I'm guessing hand.
Yes. Again, because of who I am, people send me case reports. Mm-hmm. You know, people send me stories about crash and burns, or, you know, I'm fairly active online, so I may come across a news report or something like that. And again, as I said, I'm a professional, I am a BDSM catastrophe reconstruction specialist. And so when it crashes and burns, just like when an aircraft goes down, we go back and we reconstruct the situation and we find out how that could have been prevented. And it's emerging that people are letting themselves get too far from their emergency cutting device, and they're paying the price for that.
My thought is that humans are intelligent. Ideally, we learn, we grow, we cull wisdom from things, and we improve, right? And so it seems like so many people will email me, and I'm sure they email you about, how do I become a sex educator? How can I do this? And it seems like you've more just seen that there's a need and just been like, hey, 5 second rule. Like, just, this is a thing that clearly needs to be a thing. And no one's necessarily, it doesn't sound like gave you permission to do that. But so in terms of, I guess, empowering yourself to step into the teacher role, that journey, it seems interesting to me, because a lot of people would be almost too insecure or feel like they need permission before they can do that sort of thing.
Well, it's funny because, you know, when I first published SM 101 in 1992, I was not a member of the Bay Area BDSM community's A-list. I wasn't one of the beautiful people or one of the celebrities or anything like that. I was a journeyman male top who had done something moderately interesting about 14 years prior to that by starting a male-dominant female-submissive club. Mm-hmm. But I think there was at least some sense that I had done something rather above my proper social station in the community. Mm-hmm. But
did people like give you a hard time about it?
Very few people gave me a hard time about it directly. Okay. But it's like, him? You know, because as I said, I wasn't one of the A-listers. I wasn't one of the designated celebrities. But my initial goal in writing SM 101 was I wanted to do something equivalent to teaching about a one-day introduction to BDSM workshop. And of course, 1992, we didn't call it BDSM. That's a cyber era term.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What'd you call it back then?
S&M.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I'd been doing it long enough that in terms of the basics, I knew that I knew that I knew what I was talking about. I had done a very large number of clock hours of BDSM play with, for the most part, very good outcomes. I'd, at that point, probably attended well over 100, possibly 200 or more educational programs. Mm-hmm. So I knew I had the knowledge, and I knew the areas that I was pretty solid on, and I put them in the book and I put it out there. It was actually my fourth book, and by now the various erotic boutiques and leather stores, that this book needed to exist. And the distinction, I think, of my book is, I'm pretty sure I am the first ever heterosexual who stepped forth and, using his real name, wrote about BDSM from the standpoint of a practitioner.
Ah.
That the practitioners that had come before me, such as Larry Townsend or Pat Califia, were gay and lesbian, or there were research, well, there were, you know, novelists like Anne Rice, who wrote her Beauty series, but she's always been adamant she merely fantasizes. She doesn't actually do it. Or there had been researchers like Charles Moser or Ginny Graham Scott. But I was the first practitioner who stuck his hand, the first heterosexual practitioner who stuck his hand up and said, hey, world, I do this. And it was a scary moment for me because, as I said earlier, this used to be a lot more taboo than it is now. In fact, if I have my facts right, it wasn't until 1988 that there was the first family court decision anywhere in America that being into S&M, even consensual S&M, was not by definition proof of being an unfit parent.
Oh, wow. And that's important.
Yeah. So I was kind of worried, actually, but I got to thinking, well, I'm self-employed. I can't get fired. My kids don't live with me. They can't take custody of my kids away from me. I don't have any professional licenses or security clearances that are placed at risk. Other than wag their finger at me, what can they do?
Yeah.
Really, what can they do? And I figured that by my coming out, I would make it a little easier for people who came after me to come out. And that's something I think I've tried to do pretty much my whole life in a lot of different areas, is I've tried to make it easier for the people who came after me.
Yeah.
I think I can say I've done that in SM education. I think I can say I've done that in law. I think I can say I've done that in emergency medicine. I've taught thousands of people first aid and CPR.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I try to make it easier for the people who came after me.
Well, thank you very much for that. Jay Wiseman, thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy LA schedule to hang out with me and share a little bit about your life and your knowledge.
It was my pleasure. I get down there like once or twice a year. I'll give you a call when I'm in the town next. Well, maybe we do this again.
Oh, that'd be so awesome. Are you on Twitter or Facebook, or are there any other social network places that you'd like people to find you?
Yeah, I'm kind of, well, of course, I'm on FetLife. I've got, you know, Jay Wiseman's FetLife group, and I am on Facebook. Now, there's several Jay Wisemans on Facebook, so make sure you get the right one. And I am on Twitter, at Jay Wiseman, just J-A-Y-W-I-S-E-M-A-N. And I'm fairly active on those when I'm not working on my books or teaching my classes. And, yeah, sure, come send me a friend request or follow me on Twitter or something like that.
Sweet. Sweet. All right. You crazy, naughty monkeys. Get out there and have some fun. Read some books. Get some of the books. Have fun. Go to a munch. Go to FetLife. Spank your partner. Consensually. Whatever. I don't care. Have a good day. Enjoy. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.